Greetings to all members and friends of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club. This is VK3OTN.
And I am Ian, VK3JS.
And I am Bruce, VK3UV. And together we present our broadcast bulletin of news and information for November 2020. We thank our volunteer operators who relay this broadcast on a number of frequencies and modes, which can all be found on our website, www.raotc.org.au. This month we have our normal club news and several interesting articles, and ending up with this month's joke. Club news. In September, the RAOTC held its annual general meeting, but this time it was held by Zoom video conferencing, which was very successful. The agenda items included the usual reports in all departments, and I am pleased to report that our financials are in very good shape, with thanks to our treasurer Michael Good, VK3BDL. Our membership levels are still constant at around 488. The previous office bearers offered themselves for re-election and were thus re-elected. And we welcome Peter Clee, VK8ZZ, as a new addition to the committee. We now welcome three new members to the RAOTC, and they are Ben Broadbent, VK5BB, previous call signs VK5ABE, and VK5ZBB, and he became full RAOTC member number 1796 on the 29th of September 2020. We have Colin Schultz, VK3COL, previous call signs VK3VWP and VK3KIU, and Colin became full RAOTC member number 1797 on the 3rd of October. And John Ross, VK3MK, previous call signs VK3BJR and VK3NJR, and he became full RAOTC member number 1798 on the 7th of October 2020. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.
Looking back through the early editions of OTN Journal, I discovered that even in edition number 2 of March 1986, the editor of the day was looking for historical articles, in exactly the same way that our present-day editor, Bill Roper, VK3BR, is doing with each edition of OTN. And here is just such an article from edition 2, March 1986, and it's entitled First Big Broadcast. It was 3:16 p.m. on the blistering hot Sunday, July the 2nd, 1921. The place was Jersey City. Jack Dempsey, the heavyweight boxing champion of the world, and George Carpentier, the handsome European champion and orchid man of France, had just entered the ring. In a moment, the bell would announce the first round of the much-publicized Battle of the Century. I sat at ringside, my mouth cupped to a telephone. At the other end of a special wire 2.5 miles long was another telephone, and a foot away or so, a telephone mouthpiece attached to the largest commercial radio phone transmitter that had ever been built. Into my mouthpiece I intoned, "Ladies and gentlemen, the first mass radio broadcast in history had begun." This was not to be the first broadcast sent out over the airwaves. A few radio stations had opened and were sending voices and scratchy phonograph records over the air. and a broadcast of the Harding-Cox election returns had kindled interest in radio. But the audience that awaited our broadcast that sticky afternoon numbered between 200 and 300,000, and it was located in some 200 theatres and lodge halls, ballrooms and barns from Maine to Florida, and as far inland as western West Virginia. This experiment, frowned upon as just plain crazy by financiers, had been built on the enthusiastic dream of young David Sarnoff. To pull it off, Sarnoff and I weaseled $1,500 from a special account of the then new Radio Corporation of America. The cheerfully stubborn Sarnoff first suggested sending entertainment and information over the air in 1915, when he was 24. The American Marconi Company, for which he was assistant traffic manager, had been so skeptical that its board of directors laughed heartily when it turned thumbs down on his idea. I first heard of his scheme one November evening in 1916, when he came to my desk at the Marconi Company from his office down the hall and plopped a stack of papers in front of me. David Sarnoff was my boss. I was 27, he 18 months younger. "Wish you'd read this when you have time," he said politely. I picked up his notes. Quote, "I have in mind a plan to make radio a household utility, such as the piano or the phonograph," I read. "A radio transmitter with a range of 25 or 50 miles at the point where music is produced. The receiver is in the form of a radio music box, having several wavelengths changeable with the pressing of a button." End of quote. I read on excitedly. "Amplifying tubes and a loud-speaking telephone," Sarnoff suggested, "could be neatly mounted in a box to be placed on the parlour table. It could receive music, lectures, even baseball scores. These radio music boxes could be produced in quantity for as little as $75 each," Sarnoff said, and he predicted the day would come when a million families would own them. I was completely sold on the idea, but each time Sarnoff brought up the subject, which he did frequently, our company, absorbed by the Radio Corporation of America in 1919, turned him down. Then in 1921, his luck changed. As it happened, a man named Tex Rickard opened the door for him. While Sarnoff and I were talking about radio, promoter Rickard had Europe and America talking about the coming prize fight. Press excitement was high, and Rickard started erecting a wooden arena at Boyle's 30 Acres in Jersey City. Here was our chance. Millions wanted to see the fight, but Rickard's arena seated only 9,100. If we could offer it on the air, blow by blow, while it was happening, we could have a vast audience. We lacked several things, however, including money. Then Sarnoff, digging into his books as general manager, discovered $2,500 of RCA money in accumulated rentals of ship's wireless equipment. "Take it," he said to me. Then he added cautiously, "but don't spend a nickel more than $1,500. I was editor of Wireless Age at the time. This was a little magazine read by hundreds of do-it-yourself amateurs who had built crude receiving and sending sets, assembling jumbles of wires, coils, and condensers on their wives' breadboards. If these hams could be organized and their receivers tuned to a specific wavelength, we might send out a program for them to pick up, provided, of course, we could find or build a transmitter big enough. In Wireless Age, I asked the amateurs to get ready to receive a broadcast of the fight. Also, the National Amateur Wireless Association alerted its members. 200 hams agreed to stand by. The next problem was a transmitter. Time was getting short when a radio fan named J. Owen Smith, a skilled technician, rushed in one day with important news. General Electric was building at its Schenectady plant the world's largest commercial radio phone transmitter. It was to be for the Navy. We asked to borrow it, but found the Navy rather stiff-necked about lending it to some crazy amateurs. Then one day, Smith brought in a young fellow he called Frank, who listened attentively while I talked about our plan. He asked shrewd questions, and at last seemed convinced. Our promise to give the machine the world's toughest test seemed to please him. He said he'd arrange the loan. "Who was that?" I asked when he had gone. "Former Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Frank Roosevelt," Smith said. That was just 2 months before Mr. Roosevelt was stricken with polio. The Navy told us we could use the transmitter, but to handle it gently. General Electric sent an engineer to help us install it. Tex Rickard had given us permission to set up ringside poles for our antenna, but he went broke before the arena was finished, and John Ringling, the circus man, put up some money. Ringling said, "No radio." Fortunately, we argued him out of that. Now we got the telephone company to stretch a line from Boyle's 30 acres to the Lackawanna Railway Terminal at Hoboken, 2.5 miles away. The railroad had abandoned its experiments with wireless train dispatching, but still had a radio tower. We stretched our antenna from it to the station tower 450 feet away. The railway let up house the transmitter in the shack in the yards where the Pullman porters changed uniforms. Then another obstacle cropped up. Telephone regulations prohibited us from putting any phone conversation on the air. I was discouraged, but Owen Smith took the hurdle in stride. Our phone line could not be hooked to the transmitter. It could be attached only to another telephone. There was no regulation against having two telephones stand 3 inches apart, however, one facing the other. So Smith put a 5-inch diaphragm into the receiving telephone and hooked another telephone with a big diaphragm to the radio transmitter. My voice would leap the gap.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.
But where could we find amplifiers large enough to fill a theatre or assembly hall with sound? Owen Smith solved that too. He bought 300 outmoded tulip phonograph horns at a salvage yard for 30 cents each, and with some friends worked day and night fastening them to hearing aids. The amplifiers worked. Then these devices were distributed by parcel post, with mimeographed operating instructions to the amateurs who had volunteered to handle the receiving in the hope that they would use them to take care of the public. None of these amateurs was to be paid, of course. Most of them, after installing their sets and aerials at the theatres, were to be out a good deal of money from their pockets. Now I explained our theatre plan to the Organisation of Vaudeville Theatre Owners in New York. They promptly turned me down. Beaten, I was slinking down the corridor when an office door opened a few inches. A tiny man beckoned me to the crack and whispered, "You got a good idea. Don't give up. You can use my theatres. I'm Marcus Lowe." That did it. Lowe was respected as one of the shrewdest leaders in the industry. When he announced our radio show, the others capitulated. Since no one had ever given a blow-by-blow description of a fight to a mass of listeners, I now began spending hours preparing for the broadcast by shadowboxing in front of a mirror and singing out each move. It soon became apparent to me that no one could accurately describe every blow. So I adopted the scheme of collecting punches, which is still in use. I'd say, "He jabs, now, again, and again," or "Five short jabs," or "They trade punches." We needed advanced publicity, but we did not get it. The only newspaper to pay us any attention was the New York Times. The day before the fight, it devoted a column to the broadcast, followed by a brief mention on the sports page. I was at ringside early on July the 2nd, testing. From the railway shack at the other end of my telephone line, Owen Smith reported all well. Crowds were already gathering outside the theatres and my signal was coming in fine. At last, Dempsey, in his ragged red sweater, and the pale Carpentier, in a grey silk Japanese kimono, were in the ring. Dempsey was unshaven and scowling, but the handsome Frenchman smiled and lifted his clasped hands overhead, shaking them at the cheering crowd. That was when I said, "Ladies and gentlemen," to begin the first big radio broadcast. As the gong clanged to start the fight, Carpentier leapt to the attack. Flashing and dazzling, he punched fast and often, but not hard. Soon Dempsey had the left side of Carpentier's face bleeding, and after 2 minutes, the Frenchman was wobbling. The gong saved him. In the next round, Carpentier landed one blow that staggered Dempsey, but the sturdy champion finished the round strong. At my telephone, I was pouring out words while wondering whether they were actually going over the air. Round three found Carpentier weary as Dempsey pounded him with piston-like blows. In the fourth round, Dempsey, bigger and more solidly built, waded in to finish the fight. "The Frenchman is down," I shouted into my telephone. "He's on his hands and knees. The referee is counting. 3, 4. Carpentier makes no effort to rise. 6, 7. He's sinking to the mat. 9, 10. The fight is over. Jack Dempsey remains heavyweight champion of the world." There were handshakes and congratulatory backslaps and the delighted bellow of Reuters news service manager, "You gave us a worldwide newspaper beat. We scooped everyone in London and Paris with the news of the world's first real broadcast." In a few minutes, Sarnoff and I were looking at a terse cablegram from RCA's president, who was vacationing in London. "You have made history." We were tired and bleary-eyed, but in our mind's eyes, Sarnoff and I were seeing the crowds that were pouring out of the theatres and halls in Pittsburgh, St. Augustine, Boston and Washington, Albany, Philadelphia and Akron, their ears full of a modern miracle. We knew then that the era of radio for millions had begun. And that article was written by J. Andrew White and published in edition number 2 of OTN Journal of March 1986.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. We continue with part 2 of the article referred to last month, The Uncertain Future of Ham Radio. Here is the last few lines of part 1. "The people of my era will be gone. The people who got into it when it was magic to tune into Radio Moscow. But Grandpa's ham radio set isn't that big a deal compared to today's technology. That doesn't have to be said. That's normal. Gramps's radios are really still around. However, ham radio is really a social hobby, or it has been a very social hobby. The rag chewing has historically been the big part of it. Martin Dewey, K5FLU, the founder of radio accessories maker MFJ Enterprises, he says, "Here in Mississippi, you get to 5 or 6 o'clock, and you have a big network going on and on. Some of them are half drunk, chatting with you. It's a social group, and they won't even talk to you unless you're in that group. But Jew, 76, notes the ham radio space has fragmented significantly beyond rag-jewing and DXing, and he credits the shift to digital. That's where MFJ has moved with its antenna-heavy catalogue of products. Ham radio is connected to the internet now. With a simple, inexpensive handheld walkie-talkie and through repeater systems connected to the internet, you're set to go. You don't need an HF radio with a huge antenna to talk to people anywhere in the world. To that end, last year, MFJ unveiled the RigPi Station Server, a control system made up of a Raspberry Pi paired with open source software that allows operators to control radios remotely from their iPhones or web browser. Some folks can't put up an antenna, but that doesn't matter anymore because they can use somebody else's radio through these RigPis. He's careful to note that the RigPi concept isn't plug and play. You still need to know something about networking, how to open up a port, but he sees the space evolving along similar lines. It's all going more and more toward digital modes. In terms of equipment, I think it'll all be digital at some point, right at the antenna all the way until it becomes audio. Outside the United States, there are some notable bright spots. This collective of national amateur radio associations around the globe represents ham's interest to the International Telecommunication Union, the ITU, a specialised United Nations agency that allocates and manages spectrum. In fact, in China, Indonesia and Thailand, amateur radio is positively booming. China's advancing technology and growing middle class with disposable income has led to a dramatic increase in operators, Sumner says. Indonesia is subject to natural disasters as an island nation, spurring interest in emergency communication, and its president is a licensed operator. Trends in Thailand are less clear, but he believes here too that a desire to build community response teams is driving curiosity about ham radio. So, Sumner says, you have to be careful not to subscribe to the notion that it's all collapsing everywhere. China is also changing the game in other ways, putting cheap radios on the market. A few years ago, an entry-level handheld UHF-VHF radio cost around $300. Now, thanks to Chinese manufacturers like Beifeng, you can get one for under $25. HF radios are changing too, with the rise of software-defined radio. It's the low-cost radios that have changed ham radio and the future thereof, and will continue to do so, says Jeff Crispino, CEO of Nualec, a company in Wheatfield, New York, that makes test equipment and software-defined radios, where demodulating a signal is done in code, not hardwired electronics. SDR was originally primarily for military operations, because they were the only ones who could afford it. But over the past 10 years, this stuff has trickled down to become to $20 if you want. Activities like plane and boat tracking and weather satellite communication were unheard of with analog, but are made much easier with SDR equipment, Crispino says. Nualec often hears from customers about how they're leveraging the company's products. For example, about 120 members from the group Space Australia to collect data from the Milky Way as a community project. They are using an SDR with a low noise amplifier from Nualec with a homemade horn antenna to detect the radio signal from interstellar clouds of hydrogen gas. We will develop products from that feedback loop, like for hydrogen line detection, we've developed accessories for that, so you can tap into astronomical events with a $20 device and a $30 accessory. Looking ahead, the Neuralec team has been talking about how to flatten the learning curve and to lower the bar to entry, so that the average user, not only the technically adept, can explore and develop their own novel projects within the world of ham radio. It is an increasingly fragmented space, but I don't think that has negative connotations. Where you can pull in totally unique perspectives, you get unique applications. We certainly haven't thought of all of it yet. The ham universe is affected by the world around it, by culture, by technology, by climate change, by the emergence of a new generation. And amateur radio enthusiasts are a varied and vibrant community of millions of operators, new and experienced and old and young, into robotics or chatting or contesting or emergency communications, excited or nervous or pessimistic or upbeat about ham radio will look like decades from now. As Michelle, the former ARRL CEO, puts it, every ham radio has their own perspective. What we've learned over the 100 years plus is that there will always be these battles. AM modulation versus single sideband modulation, whatever it may be. The technology evolves, and the marketplace will follow where the interests lie. The author of this article was Julian Pepitone, and she is a freelance technology, science and business journalist and a frequent contributor to the IEEE Spectrum. So there it is. Nearly everything stated in this article also refers to the local scene here in Australia. It really is thought-provoking, but what are we going to do about it? The ball is in your court. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. And it has been a long-standing practice of these broadcasts to finish off with something humorous. So here is today's offering. A news journalist with the CBS News did a story on gender roles in Kabul, Afghanistan, several years before the US involvement in the Afghan conflict. She noted that women customarily walked 5 paces behind their husbands. She recently returned to Kabul and observed that women still walk behind their husbands. Despite the overthrow of the oppressive Taliban regime, the women now seem to and are happy to maintain the old customs. One of the Afghani women was asked, "Why do you now seem happy with an old custom that you once tried so desperately to change?" The woman looked the journalist straight in the eyes and without hesitation said, "Landmines." No matter what language we speak or where we go to, the moral of the story is, behind every man there is a really smart woman. Thank you for listening. This now concludes our session for this month, and, all being well, we shall be back with you on Monday, the 7th of December, 2020. A reminder, if you want to contact us, please do so via our website, www.raotc.org.au. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying 73, and listening now for any check-ins and callbacks for those relay stations that have an operator available. Thank you.